Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. In the spring of 1989, 20-year-old Charles Horvath Allen arrived in the Canadian city of Kelowna, British Columbia. Like so many young backpackers, he was chasing adventure. He picked up odd jobs, met new people, and settled into a campground near the shores of Okanagan Lake. Then, one day, he was simply gone. His tent was still standing. His clothes were still there. His passport, his photographs, and nearly everything he owned had been left behind. But Charles was nowhere to be found. What happened next would haunt his family for more than 3 decades. There would be rumors whispered around town. Anonymous letters delivered under mysterious circumstances. Stories, allegations, and claims that people knew exactly what happened, but were too afraid to talk. And at the center of it all was a mother who refused to give up. Year after year, trip after trip, she returned to Canada searching for answers, convinced that someone, somewhere, knew the truth about what happened to her son. But more than 30 years later, Charles Horvath Allen has never been found. Whenever I research a missing person's case, I always find myself asking the same question. What kind of place was this before it became associated with tragedy? Because before Kelowna became the place where Charles disappeared, it was, and still is, a place people dream about visiting. If someone told you they were spending the weekend in Kelowna, your first thought probably wouldn't be crime or mystery. You'd probably picture a lake, a glass of wine, a boat drifting across crystal blue water with mountains rising in every direction. And you wouldn't be wrong. Kelowna sits in the heart of British Columbia's Okanagan Valley, roughly halfway along the shoreline of Okanagan Lake, a stunning glacial lake stretching nearly 80 miles long. The lake is so large that in places it feels less like a lake and more like an inland sea. The city itself takes its name from the Silks or Okanagan First Nation. The word Kelowna is commonly translated as grizzly bear, more specifically, female grizzly bear. Now, long before European settlers arrived, the Silks people had lived throughout this valley for thousands of years, developing a rich culture centered around the land and the lake. European settlement came much later, and Kelowna was officially incorporated as a city in 1905, when only about 600 people called it home. Now, those early residents built an economy around orchards, agriculture, and transportation across Okanagan Lake. More than a century later, Kelowna has grown into the largest city in British Columbia's interior, with a metropolitan population of well over 220,000 people. Yet despite that growth, there's something about Kelowna that still feels, comfortable. It's a city that somehow manages to feel both lively and relaxed at the same time. People don't seem to be in as much of a hurry. You can spend the morning walking through downtown cafes, the afternoon on a vineyard patio overlooking endless rows of grapevines, and the evening watching the sun disappear behind the mountains as the lake turns shades of gold and deep blue. It's not difficult to understand why so many people retire here, or why so many tourists never want to leave. The Okanagan Valley has become one of Canada's premier wine regions, home to more than 200 wineries producing internationally recognized vintages. The combination of long, hot summers, relatively mild winters, and fertile soil creates ideal growing conditions not only for grapes, but for cherries, peaches, apricots, apples, and pears. Driving through the valley in late summer means passing roadside fruit stands every few miles, with handwritten signs advertising fresh-picked cherries or peaches harvested just hours earlier. And if wine isn't your thing, there are plenty of other reasons people fall in love with Kelowna. There's Kangaroo Creek Farm, one of the city's most unusual attractions, where visitors can wander through open enclosures and interact with kangaroos, wallabies, capybaras, sugar gliders, and other surprisingly friendly animals. It's one of those places that sounds almost too strange to be real until you actually see photos of people standing face-to-face with kangaroos in the middle of British Columbia. Then there's Loyley Floating Sauna, permanently moored along Kelowna's waterfront. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't exactly jump at the chance to plunge into freezing water. The idea is wonderfully simple, though. You sit inside a traditional Finnish sauna until you're completely warmed through. Then you step outside and dive directly into the Okanagan Lake before jumping back into the heat. Apparently, people swear by it. I have to admit, I'd probably spend more time thinking about the cold plunge than actually taking it. If you'd rather stay above the water than in it, Earhart Aviation has been taking visitors on float plane tours over the valley for decades. Imagine lifting off directly from the lake, banking over vineyards, orchards, and mountains before looking down on the entire Okanagan spread out beneath you. It has to be one of the best ways to appreciate just how enormous and beautiful that landscape really is. And then there's Ogopogo. You really can't talk about Kelowna without talking about Ogopogo. Now, every great lake seems to have a legend. And Okanagan Lake is no exception. For generations, stories have been told about a mysterious creature living beneath these waters. Now, today, it's affectionately known as Ogopogo, often compared to Scotland's Loch Ness Monster. But the story actually reaches much deeper than modern tourism. In Silic's tradition, the being associated with the lake is a powerful spiritual figure connected to the water whose origins long predate the playful green monster you see on postcards and souvenir shops today. Over the years, the legend evolved into one of Canada's best-known cryptid stories. And today, you'll find Ogopogo statues, artwork, and references scattered throughout Kelowna's waterfront. It's the kind of local folklore that gives a place personality. Every town has something. A ghost story, a haunted hotel, a mysterious creature. Ogopogo is Kelowna's something. But for all its beauty, Kelowna in 1989 also had another side. Like many resort communities, it attracted people from every walk of life. Families on vacation, college students, seasonal fruit pickers, backpackers looking for temporary work, people starting over, and people just passing through. And Charles fit perfectly into that world. He wasn't unusual. He was a 20-year-old hitchhiking between orchards and campgrounds while picking up odd jobs. He would have blended into the background. And one place in particular reflected that transient lifestyle. Tiny Town Campground. Unlike the polished waterfront parks visitors enjoy today, Tiny Town had a reputation as a rough, inexpensive campground where backpackers, seasonal workers, hitchhikers, and people living on very little money could stay for a few dollars a night. It wasn't glamorous, but for someone like Charles, it served its purpose. It offered an affordable place to pitch a tent while looking for work. Now today, Tiny Town is gone. The campground has long since disappeared, and the property near Gyro Beach has been redeveloped into parking areas and condominiums. If you visited today, you would probably have no idea that a young English backpacker once pitched his tent there before vanishing without a trace. Places move on. Parking lots replace campgrounds. Condos replace empty fields. People walk their dogs, sip coffee, and watch the sunset, completely unaware of the history beneath their feet. Gyro Beach itself has become one of Kelowna's most popular family destinations, with sandy beaches, volleyball courts, a children's playground, food vendors, and paddleboard rentals. On a warm summer afternoon, it's full of laughter, music, families. It's almost impossible to reconcile that peaceful image with the fact that just steps away stood a campground that became the last known home of one of Canada's most enduring missing person mysteries. And maybe that's what makes Charles' story so haunting. because nothing about Kelowna feels like the setting for someone to simply disappear. It's beautiful, welcoming, and full of life. But sometimes the most chilling stories don't happen in dark alleyways or abandoned buildings. Sometimes they happen in places so breathtakingly beautiful that they convince you nothing bad could ever happen there. And maybe that's exactly why no one saw it coming. You guys know by now that before we dive into the disappearance, I like to spend a moment talking about the person behind the mystery. And today, that's Charles Horvath Allen. Because when someone goes missing, especially for decades, there's a tendency for their identity to become wrapped up in the mystery. They become a case file, a newspaper headline, and a missing poster. But Charles wasn't a mystery in 1989. He was a son, a friend, a young man standing at the beginning of his adult life, filled with the same hopes and dreams that many 20-year-olds carry with them. Charles K.J. Horvath was born on August 21, 1968, at Margaret Conchinor Hospital in the small mining community of Kutchinour in northern Ontario, Canada. His mother, Denise, gave birth to a little boy with a Hungarian first name, Karoly. It was a name that connected him to his family's heritage. But like so many childhood stories, a simple moment at school would change that forever. One of his teachers struggled to pronounce Karoly and began calling him Charles instead. And the name stuck. From that point on, he was known to almost everyone as Charles. Just 5 weeks after he was born, his life took him across an ocean. His family relocated to Yorkshire in the United Kingdom, where Denise had grown up. Although he would spend most of his childhood and teenage years in England, Canada was always part of who he was. He held dual citizenship and had a unique connection to two countries, born in one, raised in another. As Charles grew older, his mother remarried, and he eventually adopted the double-barreled surname Horvath Allen. Friends and family would later describe Charles as carefree, trusting, and perhaps a little naive. He was the kind of person who saw possibilities where others saw risks, a dreamer. Of course, most of us know someone like that. The person who's always talking about future adventures. The person who believes things will work out. The person who approaches the world with curiosity instead of suspicion. And those traits can be wonderful. They can lead you to experiences that cautious people might never have. But they can also make you vulnerable. As a young man, Charles became fascinated with the country where he had been born. Canada wasn't just a place on a map. It was part of his identity. It was a place he had left before he could even form memories. He wanted to see it for himself. He wanted to visit relatives, meet new people, explore the vast country stretching from the Atlantic to the Pacific. He wanted the kind of adventure that many young travelers dream about, but never actually take. Luckily, his mother supported that dream. As an early 21st birthday gift, Denise purchased him an open airline ticket. It wasn't just a plane ticket. It was freedom and possibility. It was the beginning of an adventure. On September 22nd, 1988, Charles arrived in Montreal, Quebec. Now imagine what that must have felt like. A 20-year-old stepping off a plane in the country of his birth. An entire continent waiting in front of him. No rigid itinerary, no fixed destination, just opportunity. For the next several months, Charles began building a life for himself as a backpacker. He had enough money to support himself for about 3 months and planned to work along the way to pay for accommodations and expenses. Like thousands of young travelers before and after him, he intended to fund the journey as he went. And by all accounts, he was enjoying it. In December of 1988, Denise flew to Canada to spend an early Christmas with her son. It's one of those details that shows us how close they were. Charles wasn't running away from his family, and he wasn't trying to disappear. His mother knew where he was. They stayed in contact. They made plans together. During her visit, Denise attended a fashion show at Montreal's Delta Hotel, where Charles was participating. You can almost picture the pride she must have felt watching her son on that stage. thriving in this adventure he had dreamed about for so long. And for 2 weeks, they spent time together, celebrating Christmas early and creating memories. And then on December 18th, Denise returned home to England. At the time, there was no reason to think anything was wrong. Her son was young, healthy, excited about the future. He was exploring Canada, meeting people, finding work, and building stories he'd one day tell for the rest of his life. The last thing Denise could have known was that those ordinary moments together would become precious memories she'd replay over and over again. Because as Charles continued his journey west across Canada, neither of them could have imagined that one day people around the world would know his name, not because of how he lived, but because of how completely he would disappear. By the spring of 1989, Charles Horvath Allen had been living the kind of life that many young people dream about, but few ever actually pursue. At 20 years old, he had left behind the familiar streets of Yorkshire, England, grabbed a backpack, and set out to explore the country where he had been born. What began as an open airline ticket to Canada had become an 8-month journey, stretching across thousands of miles. Along the way, Charles visited relatives, picked up temporary jobs, slept in hostels and campgrounds, met strangers who became friends, and experienced the freedom that comes with being young enough to believe the world is mostly full of opportunity. After visiting his father, Max, and his godfather, Gabby, in northern Ontario, Charles continued westward across Canada. Like so many travelers before him, he was drawn toward the Rocky Mountains. And by late March of 1989, Charles had arrived in Banff, Alberta. For Charles, Banff became one of the most stable periods of his entire trip. He secured work and accommodation at the Rimrock Hotel, a luxury property perched high above the Bow Valley beneath Sulphur Mountain. Now for a young backpacker trying to stretch his travel budget, finding both employment and a place to stay was a huge win. And what's remarkable is that decades later, people who worked there still remembered him. One manager recalled the distinctive sound of Charles's boots echoing through the hallways as he walked the quarters of the hotel. That's a small detail, but those are often the details that stay with people. Not a dramatic moment, not a life-changing event, just the sound of someone moving through the ordinary routines of daily life. When I read that memory, I couldn't help but think about how strange it is that something as simple as a pair of footsteps can actually outlive a person. On April 17, 1989, Charles made a collect phone call to his mother in England. The conversation lasted only a short time, but it would become one of the most important moments in the entire story. They talked about their upcoming birthdays. Charles would soon be turning 21, a milestone birthday that he was excited to celebrate. And Denise's birthday fell around the same time. Together, they discussed a plan that reflected Charles' adventurous spirit. Rather than returning immediately to England, they talked about meeting in Hong Kong. Denise had spent part of her childhood there, and the idea of reuniting halfway across the world seemed fitting for a young traveler who had spent months chasing experiences and seeing new places. There was nothing unusual about the conversation, nothing alarming, nothing that suggested either of them should be worried. If anything, it was exactly the kind of conversation you'd expect between a mother and son who fully expected to see each other again. Neither of them could possibly have known that it would be the last time Denise would ever hear Charles's voice. Sometime around May 2nd or May 3rd, Charles reportedly called his father Max from Banff and told him that he would be traveling to Kelowna, British Columbia. And then the next day, he boarded a Greyhound bus. At the time, Kelowna was becoming a popular destination for seasonal workers, travelers, and backpackers. It offered opportunities for temporary employment, especially for young people willing to work hard and live cheaply. For Charles, it seemed like the perfect next stop. He arrived in Kelowna on May 3rd, 1989. Now, initially, he stayed at the Kelowna Gospel Mission on May 4th, 5th, and 6th, while he looked for work and more permanent accommodations. Over the following weeks, Charles did exactly what thousands of backpackers did before smartphones, online job boards, and social media existed. He hustled. He registered with employment agencies, asked around for work. He accepted temporary labor jobs, hitchhiked from one location to another, and he relied on recommendations from strangers. Because Charles was known for being friendly and outgoing, those strangers often became acquaintances, employers, or temporary hosts. Witnesses consistently described Charles as sociable, approachable, and easygoing. He was not someone who kept to himself. He enjoyed talking with people and seemed genuinely interested in those he met during his travels. And that personality helped him survive on the road. But it also meant that in the weeks leading up to his disappearance, Charles crossed paths with an enormous number of people, many of whom investigators were never able to identify. One employer, Vernon Gordon, gave Charles temporary work laying carpet. And one day, Vernon found Charles sleeping at the worksite. Rather than turning him away, he reportedly took him home for the night and suggested that he find accommodation at Tiny Town Tent and Trailer Park. It was a campground on the outskirts of Kelowna. Of course, Tiny Town would later become one of the most important locations in the entire investigation. The records from Tiny Town are frustratingly inconsistent. Now, it's believed Charles had first arrived around May 8th, but the earliest official registration appears to be May 11th. Another entry records him as checking in on May 17th under the name Carolee Horvath. Now, whether these records accurately reflected his stays remains unclear. And like many backpackers, Charles moved around constantly. Some nights he slept in campgrounds, some nights he stayed with local families, sometimes he slept at job sites, and sometimes he slept rough outdoors. This transient lifestyle would later make it extraordinarily difficult for investigators to reconstruct his final days. Despite the uncertainty, we do know that Charles remained active throughout May. He reportedly spent time with local residents on St. Paul Street in downtown Kelowna, and he worked several short-term jobs. On May 17th and 18th, he dug irrigation ditches for the Tanis family orchard. On May 23rd, a local family helped him complete paperwork to apply for welfare assistance. They later drove him toward KLO Road, where Charles intended to hitchhike into East Kelowna in search of fruit-picking work and accommodation. Now, through all of this, Charles continued making plans for the future. And that's one of the details that investigators and family members continually return to. Because on May 11th, Charles sent a fax home from Roche Stationers in Kelowna. It would be the last communication his family ever received from him. And there was nothing alarming. He was still discussing travel plans, still considering future employment, still taking steps to finalize arrangements for meeting his mother in Hong Kong, and absolutely no indication that he was planning to disappear. It's quite the opposite. Everything points towards someone who is actively planning the next chapter of his journey. And yet, mixed among those ordinary moments are several deeply unsettling stories. One witness later reported seeing Charles at Jonathan Siegel's Bistro in downtown Kelowna, speaking with an older man described as having gray hair and steel blue eyes. And according to the witness, they became concerned enough to warn Charles against attending a party with that man. And the reason they gave was chilling. They allegedly told him that if he went, he might not come back. The party was said to be taking place in Midway, British Columbia. Now, whether the warning reflected genuine knowledge, local gossip, or simple intuition, well, that part remains unknown. And the older man has never been publicly identified. And then there's another strange account. On Mother's Day, May 14th, a family reported seeing a young man they believed was Charles boarding a sailboat at Kelowna's downtown marina alongside another young traveler. The vessel was operated by an older, rugged-looking man whose behavior they found suspicious. The witnesses became concerned enough to write down the boat's registration number and report the incident to the RCMP. Amazingly, that registration number was later lost by investigators. The boat operator was never identified. Just like that, what could have been a significant lead, well, drifted away. By May 26th, Charles' money was running low, but he's still finding occasional work. Now that day, he completed a 4-hour shift at Flintstones Theme Park in Rutland. After work, he cashed his $20 paycheck at the Royal Bank in Orchard Park. The RCMP later confirmed this transaction. And it was the final confirmed sighting of Charles. Now, after leaving the bank, investigators believe he hitchhiked toward downtown Kelowna. No one knows where he went after that. No one knows who picked him up. No one knows where he spent the night, and no one knows what happened next. Now, at first, Denise tried not to worry when she didn't hear from Charles. But of course, the silence eventually became impossible to ignore. In July of 1990, Denise and her mother boarded a plane and traveled across the world to search for him themselves. What they discovered would transform a worrying disappearance into something far more sinister. When Denise visited Tiny Town, the former campground manager immediately remembered Charles. More importantly, he revealed something that would haunt the family forever. Charles had apparently left nearly everything behind. His blue pup tent, sleeping bag, backpack, clothing, his personal papers, identification, and photographs. All the possessions that a backpacker would need if he intended to continue traveling. The manager handed Denise three items: a rosary, a tiny Bible, and a strap from one of Charles's boots. Imagine being handed those items. Just a few objects that proved he had once been there and was now gone. Much of Charles' property had already been discarded. Other campers had reportedly used some of his belongings, and some items had been thrown away entirely. Investigators later recovered only a few remaining possessions. But for Denise, every recovered item was both a clue and a heartbreak. And then in 1992, the case took an even stranger turn. Anonymous notes began appearing. One was delivered by a taxi driver who claimed a nervous young man had paid him to transport it, and another followed shortly afterward. The notes suggested Charles had attended a party, gotten into trouble, and ended up in Okanagan Lake. Now, nobody knew whether the letters were genuine confessions, rumors, or cruel hoaxes, but they were specific enough to trigger a search. Volunteer divers spent 6 days examining the lake using underwater cameras and search equipment. And then, on April 3rd, 1992, they found a body. For one brief moment, it seemed the mystery might finally be solved. But it wasn't Charles. The body belonged to another missing man. Months later, another unexplained lead emerged when a young woman arrived at the Pendosi Inn looking for Denise. She reportedly told staff that the family was wasting its time searching because she knew what happened to Charles. And she said she'd been too frightened to come forward earlier. But before Denise returned, the woman disappeared and her identity was never established. To this day, nobody knows who she was or what she knew. And that's what makes all of this so sad. Because after more than 3 decades, investigators still believe there are people who know more than what they've said. The RCMP has never closed the file. Successive investigators, including Corporal Lisa Cullen and later Sergeant Paul Gosling, have continued pursuing leads whenever they emerge. And although a British court legally declared Charles presumed dead in 2020, that ruling did not solve the mystery. It simply acknowledged what the evidence already suggested, that a young traveler vanished in the Okanagan Valley in the spring of 1989 and never returned. But the truth of what happened after Charles walked away from that bank on May 26th, that remains hidden. Somewhere between a final paycheck, a hitchhiked ride, a campground, a party rumor, anonymous notes, and a mother's decades-long search, the story disappears into darkness. And after all these years, that darkness still hasn't given up its secrets. But of course, there are plenty of theories. So let's dive in. Whenever we cover a disappearance on The Last Trip, there comes a point where the facts run out. Every investigation reaches that place where certainty ends and questions begin. So what happened to Charles? More than 35 years later, investigators still don't know. His case is open. No one has ever been charged. And despite a British court legally declaring Charles dead, nobody can say with certainty where he died, when he died, or who, if anyone, was responsible. And that's why the theories have emerged. Some seem more plausible than others. Some are based on witness statements and rumors, and some are based on hard facts. The theory that has gained the most traction over the years, and perhaps the one that feels hardest to ignore, is that Charles was murdered. His mother has never tried to hide that this is what she believes. She believes his remains are still out there somewhere, and she believes there are people walking around today who know exactly what happened. When I think about Denise's position, it's hard not to understand why she feels that way. Because if you strip away all the rumors and speculation, there are certain facts that remain stubbornly difficult to explain. Charles left behind nearly everything he owned, the possessions that were essential to his life. The people voluntarily disappear sometimes. People choose to start over. People walk away from their old lives. But they generally don't leave behind the very items they need to survive. And they generally don't abandon plans they were actively making. Charles wasn't a drifter who had cut ties with his family. He was communicating regularly with his mother. He was discussing a future reunion in Hong Kong, making inquiries about flights. He was looking for work and planning ahead. Everything about his behavior suggests a young man focused on tomorrow. And that alone is one of the strongest arguments in favor of foul play. And then there are the anonymous notes, the mysterious woman who claimed she knew what happened. The witness who allegedly warned Charles not to attend a party because he might not come back. The unidentified older men who appear repeatedly in various accounts connected to his final days. Now, none of these pieces prove murder, but together they create a picture that feels pretty unsettling. Now, one particular homicide theory has lingered for decades. And interestingly, it begins almost immediately after Charles arrived at a tiny town campground. According to accounts that surfaced later, a group of American bikers stopped at Tiny Town while traveling through British Columbia on their way to the Falklands Stampede. It's a large rodeo and motorcycle gathering that still takes place today. Years afterward, a tip allegedly surfaced suggesting that a polite English backpacker had been killed by a biker attempting to earn a gang patch or prove himself to other members. Now, it's important to say that investigators have never publicly verified this claim. No evidence has ever been released. Nothing connecting any specific biker gang to Charles's disappearance. But the story has persisted for decades. Part of the reason it persists is because it attempts to explain one of the central mysteries of the case. How does a sociable, trusting young traveler disappear so completely without anyone immediately noticing? Now, if something happened at or near Tiny Town, it could explain why his belongings remained behind. It could explain why he never returned to collect them. It could explain why some witnesses later seemed frightened to talk. Now, again, none of that makes the theory true, but it helps explain why Denise continues to view it as one of the more significant leads. Another theory centers around the possibility that Charles attended a party shortly before his disappearance. Now, this idea has surfaced repeatedly over the years through rumors, anonymous letters, and witness accounts. In fact, many of the strange details surrounding the case do seem to point back towards some type of gathering or party. Like the anonymous notes delivered to Denise, they suggest that Charles attended a party where violence occurred. The witness at the restaurant who warned him about traveling with an older man also referenced a party. Now, other rumors have suggested that an altercation took place. Some versions claim Charles was accidentally killed, while others suggest he was intentionally harmed. But here's the frustrating thing. After all these years, there has never been any publicly released evidence proving that such a party ever occurred. No location, no guest list, no forensic evidence, and no witnesses willing to publicly testify. It's one of those theories that feels tantalizingly close to being solved, yet remains frustratingly out of reach. And personally, if Charles did attend some type of gathering shortly before he disappeared, I think that's one of the most important unanswered questions in the case. Because when investigators lose track of someone, the final social event they attended often becomes incredibly significant, especially when that person is never seen again. Of course, there is the theory that Charles voluntarily disappeared. And to be fair, every long-term missing persons case eventually raises this possibility. Some relatives reportedly told investigators that Charles had occasionally talked about disappearing or living off-grid. At first glance, that sounds compelling. After all, he was adventurous and independent. But what 20-year-old hasn't said that? And when you look closer, the theory starts to feel less convincing. Charles maintained contact with his family. He was extremely close with his mother. And most importantly, he left behind virtually everything he owned. If someone wanted to start a new life, why leave behind your identification, photos, backpack, clothing, personal papers? Why walk away with really absolutely nothing? And why never contact your mother again? Not once in 35 years? For me, that's the part that makes voluntary disappearance difficult to accept. Because at some point, the theory requires us to believe that a young man who spent months communicating with his family suddenly chose to vanish forever without a word. And while stranger things have happened, it feels inconsistent with the Charles we know. But what strikes me most about this case is how many people seem to possess fragments of the story. Someone writes anonymous notes. Someone reports suspicious activity on a sailboat. Someone warns about a party. Someone remembers a biker story. Someone recalls seeing him with an unidentified man. It's as if the truth exists in pieces scattered across the Okanagan Valley, but no one has ever assembled those pieces into a complete picture. So that's why there are plenty of theories, because almost every theory feels like it might contain a piece of the truth, yet none of them fully explain what happened. The real question is whether someone still remembers enough of that truth to finally bring Charles home. One thing I always try to remind myself when researching cases like this is that we have to take advantage of hindsight. In 1989, Charles wasn't making dangerous decisions that stood out from everyone else. He was doing exactly what thousands of young backpackers did every single summer. He hitchhiked, stayed in cheap campgrounds, hung out with people he had just met. He picked up temporary jobs wherever he could find them and slept wherever he could afford. That was, and in many ways still is, the backpacker culture. If you've ever spent time traveling on a tight budget, you know that your world becomes incredibly dependent on strangers. Someone recommends a campground or offers you a couch for the night. An employer tells you about another job across town. A traveler you met yesterday tells you about a great party tonight. Every decision depends on trust. Most of the time, that trust is rewarded. Sometimes it isn't. Pelauna has always been a city built around tourism. People come for the lake, the sunshine, the wineries, the hiking trails, and the orchards. During the summer months, the population swells with vacationers, students, fruit pickers, seasonal workers, backpackers. It's the kind of place where a new face arrives every day and disappears again just as quickly. Even today, tourism remains one of the region's largest industries. And that's what makes backpacking through a place like Kelowna so appealing. You can disappear, but in a good way, not disappear from your family, but rather disappear from deadlines, routines, and responsibilities. You wake up not entirely sure where you'll sleep that night. Somehow, that's part of the adventure. Now, I've always understood that appeal. Some of my favorite travel memories come from changing plans at the last minute because someone said, hey, you have to see this place or come with us. Those spontaneous moments often become the best stories, but they also require an incredible amount of faith in people you only just met. And Charles seemed to have that kind of faith. He was described as friendly, trusting, outgoing. He didn't isolate himself. He connected with people easily. Now, that personality probably helped him find work, find rides, and find places to stay throughout Canada. But also meant he was constantly expanding the circle of people who knew where he was. And after 35 years, investigators still don't know which one of those people might matter. And back in 1989, one of the places that attracted travelers like Charles was Tiny Town Campground. And that's long gone. History disappears surprisingly fast. Not the events, but the evidence of the events. Buildings come down, parking lots become apartment buildings, life moves forward, but the unanswered questions stay exactly where they were. And the reality is that Kelowna is still considered a safe destination for most travelers. Millions of people visit the Okanagan every year without incident. Like many cities, the majority of reported crime is property crime, like theft from vehicles, bicycles, unsecured belongings, rather than random violence against visitors. As with almost anywhere, police and local residents tend to recommend staying aware of your surroundings, securing your belongings, and avoiding isolated areas alone at night. And of course, being cautious about accepting rides or invitations from people you don't know well. Those recommendations might sound obvious today, but travel has changed dramatically since Charles's trip. When Charles was backpacking across Canada, there were no smartphones, GPS, or location sharing. No texting your mom to say, "I made it." No way to instantly look up the reputation of a campground or the reviews of a hostel. If you disappeared between towns, there wasn't a digital trail following behind you. There were only memories, witnesses, and paper records. Maybe a postcard or payphone call. Maybe a handwritten campground register. And that's it. And I think Charles' story serves as an important reminder that the spirit of adventure and personal safety, they don't have to compete with each other. You can still take the scenic route and meet new people. You can still backpack across countries and sleep under the stars. Just don't let the excitement of the journey convince you that everyone you meet has the same intentions that you do. Because almost every traveler has a story about the stranger who became a lifelong friend. I have so many. But every once in a while, a story like Charles reminds us that not every stranger is someone you'll be lucky to have met. And sometimes the smallest decision, a ride, a conversation, an invitation to a party, or one more night at a campground, can quietly become the moment when everything changes. So always put your personal safety first when traveling. More than 35 years have passed since Charles Horvath Allen disappeared. But for his family, time never really moved on. To them, Charles isn't a missing person or an unsolved case. He's a son who never came home. A 20-year-old whose life was just beginning when it suddenly and inexplicably stopped. If Charles is out there somewhere, his family deserves to bring him home. If he was the victim of a crime, they deserve to know the truth. Charles was 6 feet tall, weighed approximately 165 pounds, and had dark brown hair and dark brown eyes. He had a tattoo of a skull with a Mohican hairstyle on his upper left arm and a pierced left ear. If you know anything, no matter how small it might seem, you can contact the RCMP investigator Darren Feist by email at darren.feist@rcmp-grc.gc.ca or anonymously through Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS or crimestoppers.net. There is currently a $5,000 reward for information that leads to the discovery of human remains confirmed through DNA testing to be those of Charles Horvath Allen. And sometimes the missing piece in a decades-old mystery isn't new evidence. It's someone finally deciding that after all these years, it is time to tell the truth. If today's episode moved you, please share it. Someone who lived in Kelowna in 1989, someone who stayed at Tiny Town, or someone who has carried it secret for decades may still hear Charles' story. Because after 35 years, hope may be quieter than it once was, but it isn't gone. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.